Casey Skulls from VH1's Rock of Love, and this is Talk of Love, the new podcast. This isn't just reality, this is real life.
Hey everyone, it's Lacey motherfucking Skulls, and this is Talk of Love, episode 54. So this is another episode of Talk of Love Presents. Talk of Love Presents is a new edition of the Talk of Love podcast, where instead of doing an interview like I normally do, instead I'll be doing a deep dive into a topic that I find to be interesting. My goal is to do these episodes about once a month. And last month I showcased the episode Predators in the Music Industry. And today's episode is called Paddock versus Whitman, the tale of two murderers. I'm sure you remember Stephen Paddock, the shooter in the devastating 2017 massacre in Las Vegas, Nevada, which happens to be my new hometown. And I will be comparing him to Charles Whitman, who was a murderer in Texas, which is my original home state. And later we'll be getting into one of my favorite topics, which is psychology. Now, I want to preface this by saying that in this episode, I'll be describing murders that have taken place. So if this is a topic that is upsetting to you, please be advised. So my husband and I, we didn't move to Las Vegas until 2019, but when the Las Vegas shooting took place 2 years earlier, my husband's dad had been living here in Las Vegas for several years. I'll never forget when his dad called us on October 1st, 2017 and informed us that he was safe, but then he told us to turn on the TV. And that's when we were horrified to see that a gunman on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel had opened fire onto a crowd of 22,000 people who were attending the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival on the Las Vegas Strip. For 10 minutes, that guy fired over 1,000 rounds of ammunition into the crowd. As people were literally running for their lives, he managed to shoot almost 500 people. 58 of them sadly were killed, and 867 people were injured. Over 400 of those injured were from gunshot wounds or shrapnel injuries, and it was the largest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. We later learned that the shooter was a man named Stephen Paddock. Stephen Paddock was 64 years old, and immediately after the shooting, as the hotel security and police began closing in on him, he ended his own life by shooting himself in the head in his hotel room at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. There were so many crazy aspects to that story, but one of the craziest aspects of the whole thing to me is the fact that no one seems to know why he did this. In the following weeks of the shooting, very little information was coming out, and what was coming out slowly. So people on social media were just chalking this up to like, well, I guess this guy is just a monster. But I never liked that answer. I was never satisfied with it. For one reason, it felt like a lazy and dismissive thing to say. You know, he's just a monster. That's not a thing. That's not anything that we can work with. And my thoughts are, if we don't actually figure this out, then how are we supposed to prevent things like this from happening in the future? Back when this happened in 2017, I remember racking my brain about this, and my husband and I were going, you know, through every possible scenario on why he could have done this. And it was then that I remembered hearing a news story from a long time ago. And it was a story about a mass shooter in Texas, which is, again, my home state. And similar to the Las Vegas shooter, this guy was also, you know, up high in a building and shot down into a crowd of people below him. I remember a few other similarities as well, but I couldn't remember all the specific details because it happened before I was born. But I do remember thinking that the two shootings did feel similar to me in quite a few ways. So I decided to look it up. So here's what I learned. And this is a crazy story. So let's take a deep dive. So the shooting that I'm thinking of that took place in Texas, that was on August 1st, 1966. It happened at the University of Texas in Austin, and the shooter's name was Charles Whitman, who later became known as the Texas Tower Shooter. Okay, so Charles Whitman, he was born in Florida in 1941, and growing up, he had a very abusive father who was violent to both him and his mother. in spite of that, he was a very polite little kid, very intelligent little kid, and he was very accomplished. He was a Boy Scout. He was an Eagle Scout. He was a talented pianist at a very young age, but his dad was an abusive perfectionist, and he was never satisfied with his son's accomplishments. His dad was a gun enthusiast, though, and he taught Charles how to shoot and how to hunt, which seemed to be the only thing that gave his dad a like feeling of pride. Little Charles was really good at shooting as well. And after high school, Charles came home one night after he'd been drinking. And when his dad realized that Charles was drunk, he started beating him. Charles was just so frightened of his dad, so tired of the abuse. He was really anxious to get away from his dad. So after that last incident with his father, he just took off without even saying a word to his dad, and he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. After qualifying as a sharpshooter in boot camp, Charles ended up serving for 18 months, interestingly, at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. He did really well while serving. He was awarded the Good Conduct Medal. He was awarded a Sharpshooter's Badge and the Marine Corps Expeditionary Medal. He was then awarded a scholarship, and he went to a preparatory school in Maryland where he studied math and physics, and then he transferred to the University of Austin where he studied mechanical engineering. In 1962, which was 2 years out of high school, and Charles was 20 years old, he met his future wife, Kathleen Leisner, and she was his first serious girlfriend, and they dated for about 6 months, and then they quickly got married. Unfortunately, though, around this time, his grades started to fall, so the Marines pulled his scholarship. He was ordered to go back to active duty, and he had to go to North Carolina for the remainder of his enlistment. Allegedly, he was really, really resentful that he wasn't allowed to continue his education. While in North Carolina, an interesting thing happened. One day, Charles Whitman was riding in a Jeep with two other Marines when the Jeep went over a steep embankment, and his Marine buddies were trapped in the crash. And by himself, he single-handedly lifted the Jeep off of them and freed them. But then he lost consciousness and he collapsed. And that put him in the hospital for 4 days. One personal issue that Charles struggled with was the fact that he had a gambling addiction. Coincidentally, I might add, Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter, he also had a gambling addiction. So that's just a little side note. But anyway, because of Charles Whitman's issues with gambling, and there was an incident where he had a gun on base and allegedly threatened a fellow Marine, and so he was court-martialed. And even though otherwise he had a great reputation with the Marines, he was demoted and then sentenced to 30 days of confinement and 90 days of hard labor. At the end of 1964, Charles Whitman was honorably discharged from the Marines. So he went back to Texas and he enrolled again at the University of Texas at Austin, this time studying architectural engineering. He also worked as a bill collector and later a bank teller. And he even volunteered as a Boy Scout leader. So he was seemingly a pretty normal, pretty decent guy as of this point in his life. Interestingly, around this time, he began writing in a daily journal. It ultimately was really great that he ended up doing this because it gives us the ability to really understand and learn how this guy thinks. And it also gives us details about his life that we might not have known about otherwise. In one of his journal entries, Charles wrote about the fact that he had hit his wife on two different occasions. He wrote that it was really upsetting to him that he had done this. He was really mad at himself. He didn't want to end up like his abusive father, and he vowed to be a better husband to his wife. When reading his journal entries, what's interesting is that he is clearly a very well-spoken, intelligent man, but he's also quite self-aware. He often wrote about having unusual intrusive thoughts, abnormal feelings of rage, sometimes confusion and violent impulses that became worse and more intense over time. And you can tell that he was fully aware that something was wrong inside of his head. In 1965, a year after leaving the Marines and moving back to Texas, he began visiting several different university doctors, expressing that he was concerned about himself and the thoughts that he was having. He also was experiencing bad headaches that were getting worse over time as well. The level of self-awareness that he had, something was happening in his mind. And the level of self-awareness, it's heartbreaking to me because when you look back, you realize he was aware that this was happening. He was aware he was on a bad trajectory and he didn't want to be on this bad trajectory, but he didn't know how to stop it or what to do about it. So that's what's so crazy about this whole thing to me. And a year later, in May of 1966, his mother, who was living in Florida, she announced that she was going to be divorcing his father because the dad was still continuing to be physically abusive to her and she couldn't handle it anymore. And you got to think, back in the 60s, people didn't really get divorced. That wasn't really a thing. They just like figured out a way to work out their problems. So this tells me that it was pretty severe, that she was just like, I can't do this anymore. And she divorced him. So Charles drove to Florida to help her pack and get out of there and to help her move back to Austin so that they could be close to each other. But when he got to Florida, he and his mom, they were so terrified of the abusive dad that they ended up having a police officer stand guard outside of their house to make sure that they were safe from the father as they were packing up the mom's stuff and getting ready to leave. Once the two were in Austin, Charles' father was obsessively calling them both. And remember, they didn't have cell phones back then. So it was like collect phone calls. And he was spending a huge amount of money making collect calls to them obsessively and begging for the mom to come back. This was a really stressful time for Charles. And unfortunately, he also started abusing amphetamines, and the severe headaches were really intensifying and continuing. On July 31st, 1966, which is 2 months after his mom left Charles's father and the day before he committed mass murder, Charles Whitman began typing a suicide note. A portion of it said, "I do not quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed." So notice the note was written in past tense, even though he had not yet done anything, but it's clear that he was planning to do something horrible. So the note continues, "I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. These thoughts constantly recur, and it requires a tremendous mental effort to concentrate on useful and progressive tasks." He talks about a session that he had with a doctor as well. And he writes, "Since then, I have been fighting my mental turmoil alone and seemingly to no avail. After my death, I wish that an autopsy would be performed on me to see if there is any visible physical disorder." His note continued, in which he wrote that he had made the decision to kill his wife and his mother, even though he loved them both. These two women were the closest people in his life and he adored them. But he had made this decision that he was going to kill them. And he wrote that he did not believe that his mother had, quote, had ever enjoyed life as she is entitled to, and that his wife had, quote, been as fine a wife to me as any man could ever hope for. Just after midnight was the date of August 1st, which is the day that he climbed to the 28th floor of the Texas University Tower and began shooting at random the people on the streets and sidewalks below. So these are the events of the day that I'm about to describe. After having already started typing his suicide note the evening before, it was now just after midnight and Charles had left his house and went to his mother's apartment. Once he was there, he went into the room where his mom was sleeping and he stabbed her in the heart, killing her. He covered her body on the bed with sheets and he put a note next to her body. And the note said, "To whom it may concern, I have just taken my mother's life. I am very upset over having done it. However, I feel that if there is a heaven, she is definitely there now. I am truly sorry. Let there be no doubt in your mind that I loved this woman with all of my heart. I don't want her to have to face the embarrassment that my actions would surely cause her. I truly do not consider this world worth living in, and I am prepared to die, and I do not want to live. I do not want to leave her to suffer alone in this world." Afterwards, he went back to his own house and he went into the bedroom where his wife was sleeping. And as she slept, he stabbed her in the heart 3 times, killing her. He then covered her body with sheets as well, just like he had done with his mom. And he paused his actions to continue writing the suicide note that he had already begun typing the evening before. He took a ballpoint pen and on the corner of the note, he wrote, "Friends interrupted, 8-1-66, which is the date. Monday, 3 a.m., both dead." That's what he wrote in the corner of his suicide letter. Then he continued writing in pen on this note, and he said, "I imagine it appears that I brutally killed both of my loved ones. I was only trying to do a quick, thorough job. If my life insurance policy is valid, please pay off my debts. Donate the rest anonymously to a mental health foundation." This is so crazy. "Maybe this research can prevent further tragedies of this type. Give our dog to my in-laws. Tell them that Kathy," which is his wife, "loves Scotchy very much. If you can find it in yourselves to grant my last wish, cremate me after the autopsy." On a side note, I gotta say about the mom, that poor woman, her asshole husband had been beating her whole adult life, and she finally musters up the courage to leave her husband, and her son's like, "Don't worry, mom, I'll come get you. I'll take care of you." And he goes and gets her, takes her back to Texas with him, only for him to murder her in her sleep. So she escaped her abusive husband and then was murdered by her own son. I mean, this poor woman, it's so sad. So in addition to his suicide note, he also left instructions that asked that two rolls of film from a camera be developed. The pictures ended up being just family photos of him and his family relaxing and enjoying a trip to Barton Springs. And one of the photos was him and his wife looking like a happy couple, and they were visiting the Alamo. And my guess as to why he wanted these pictures developed is that he wanted people to see him not as a cold-blooded killer, but as a happy family man who loved his wife and his parents and his siblings. He also wrote two personal notes to his brothers. And lastly, he wrote on an envelope labeled "Thoughts for the Day," in which he had stored a collection of other writings. On the outside of his envelope, he wrote 8-1-66, which again is the date of the mass shooting. And he wrote, "I never could quite make it. These thoughts are just too much for me." So this all tells you how methodical this guy was. He was capable of doing all these horrible actions, but he was so self-reflective as well. He knew something was wrong. He wanted people to use this experience to prevent something like this from happening in the future. I mean, it's almost like there was two different people living inside of him. He was definitely fully aware of what was going on and how much he didn't want this to be, but it seemingly couldn't help it. So another strange thing, at 5:45 in the morning, Charles made a point to call his wife's supervisor at her work. And he said that his wife was sick and wouldn't be coming in to work that day. He also made a similar call to his mother's workplace 5 hours later. Charles then packed together an arsenal of guns. He had a 12-gauge shotgun that he packed, along with a Remington 700 6mm bolt action hunting rifle, a 35 caliber pump rifle, a 30 caliber carbine, a 9mm pistol, a 25 caliber pistol, and an M19 357 Magnum revolver, and over 700 rounds of ammunition, as well as a machete. He put all of these firearms into a footlocker, along with some supplies, including food, some bottled water, headache medicine, deodorant, because, you know, when you're committing mass murder, you got to smell good, and a transistor radio. He packed all this stuff in a footlocker, and he headed over to the University of Texas. Once he arrived, he lugged the footlocker full of firearms and supplies up the flights of stairs at the landmark 307-foot-tall University Clock Tower building. What transpired next was brutal, so I just want to give you guys a little warning. If you're sensitive to graphic violence, you might want to skip the next couple of minutes, because this is tough. It was tough even for me. So here we go. Once he was inside the tower, first he killed a receptionist using the butt of one of his guns. He shot two families of tourists that were coming up the stairs, and he barricaded himself in at the observation deck to the tower, which is on the 28th floor. He spread all of his guns and rifles throughout the observation deck, and then 10 minutes before noon, he opened fire on the unsuspecting people down below. The first woman he shot was pregnant, and he shot her in the stomach, killing her unborn child. Not knowing where the shooter was, people immediately ran to help the woman, and then he started shooting them too. He shot at any pedestrian who just had the misfortune of walking around campus that day. And then when ambulance drivers went to help the victims, he would shoot the ambulance drivers too. It was vicious. He continued shooting at random anyone who was walking on the campus below, even people as far away as 500 yards from the tower, which was an area of five city blocks. And so you just got to think, some of these people were far enough away and he was so high up. People were just walking. A lot of them had no idea that this was going on. And they're walking from class to class and they're getting shot. So it was horrific. And the merciless shooting went on for an hour and a half. And you guys got to remember also, nothing like this had ever happened before. So the police were just not equipped to deal with this. There was no such thing yet as an active shooter training. And there was no way to alert everybody in the area that this was even happening. The police just had small pistols. So this guy is up 28 floors on this tower. So there's no way the police can even shoot at him. So regular citizens who just happen to have hunting rifles, they would run back to their house and get their weapons and come back to try to stop this guy. But like nothing was stopping him. Finally, after 90 minutes, several brave police officers and civilians very quietly and very carefully snuck up the stairs of the tower. And a hero Austin police officer named Houston McCoy, he stealthily crept onto the observation deck without being seen. And he was able to shoot and kill Charles Whitman, which ended the 90-minute long killing spree. In the end, 15 people were killed and over 30 were wounded. Charles Whitman was only 25 years old when he did this. An autopsy was later performed on Charles Whitman. And this is where it gets interesting. One of the most noteworthy findings was a malignant tumor that was found in his brain. The tumor was about the size of a nickel, and experts disagree on whether or not that's the actual cause of what caused him to do this shooting rampage, but it should be pointed out that the tumor was pressing on the part of the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is the part of the brain that processes emotional behavior and emotional response. It's associated with the body's response to anger, stress, and more specifically, fear. It's that part of the brain that drives the fight or flight response. So if you witness something that frightens you, if you're terrified or you're shocked or you're angry, your amygdala coordinates with your body and figures out how are you going to respond to that. So it controls that response, that fear response. And that's the part of his brain that the tumor was pressing against. I also want to add that hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. have had brain tumors, whether cancerous or malignant. So just so you know, just because you have a brain tumor doesn't mean you're going to be violent. There's a lot of people with tumors that are not violent. So anyway, that's everything. That's the gist of what you should know about Charles Whitman. So now I want to go back to the 2017 Las Vegas shooter, Stephen Paddock, because I think it's interesting to compare the two. And I'm going to tell you now about Stephen Paddock's upbringing, because what's interesting to me is, similar to Charles Whitman, Stephen Paddock was very intelligent, he was educated, and he was very ambitious and driven. So Stephen Paddock was 64 years old at the time that he committed the deadly mass shooting in Las Vegas. He was born in 1953 in a small town in Iowa, and he grew up in Arizona and then Southern California. He was the oldest of four sons, and his father was a well-known bank robber. Stephen was only 7 years old when his father was first arrested. So dad was convicted, he was sent to prison, then he escaped prison and he ended up on the FBI's most wanted list and winning the Father of the Year award. In spite of his troubled family life, Stephen graduated high school and college, and he graduated from the California State University at Northridge in 1977 with a degree in business administration. He had never been in trouble with the law, and everyone who knew him said that he was very intelligent. People also described him as very logical and very detail-oriented. And he was good at math, similar to Charles Whitman. Stephen Paddock was good at math and he was good at numbers. So he ultimately went on to work for the IRS until 1984. After that, he was a defense contract audit agency auditor for 1 year, which is basically, it's an agency for the U.S. Department of Defense. A few years later, he went on to work as an internal auditor for a company that later merged to form the company Lockheed Martin. So that's huge. He's working for like major stuff. Later, Stephen had success in real estate and he owned multiple properties and apartment buildings around Southern California and in Texas. Yes, we're back in Texas again. Around 2012, he started selling off his real estate properties and started making millions of dollars. IRS records show that by 2015, he had made around $5 to $6 million. So similar to Charles Whitman, Stephen Paddock, he loved to gamble. And his game of choice was video poker. And he had been gambling for 25 years. Apparently, he was so good at math and numbers that he was able to figure out the algorithms of these machines while he was gambling. And he won quite a lot of money doing that. As for his personal life, Stephen Paddock was married two separate times, both ending in divorce, but he did manage to stay on good terms with both of his ex-wives. In the final years of his life, Stephen had a girlfriend who he was with for 4 years, and the two of them lived together in Reno, Nevada. He was described by his neighbors and people who knew him as someone who was quiet, didn't speak much, who liked to keep a low profile and basically keep to himself. But he never really caused trouble for anybody. He never really caused problems either. He had an acquaintance from Australia, and that acquaintance and his girlfriend would actually come and visit Stephen Paddock every once in a while. And he described Stephen as someone who was intelligent, but also very methodical and generous, which was interesting. He said Stephen was very kind, very generous to him and his girlfriend whenever they would come and visit him. Stephen and his girlfriend also liked to go on cruises, and they traveled all around the world. He had a pilot's license and he owned two small planes. So he's seemingly a happy guy who really liked to live life to the fullest. The only thing negative that was really mentioned about Stephen Paddock by his girlfriend was she said that over the last few years of their relationship, he had slowly been growing distant from her and less affectionate. Apparently, he also had been on a pretty substantial losing streak regarding his gambling habit, and he lost a significant amount of money as well. But still, it doesn't seem like any obvious reasons on why he would open fire onto a crowd that was there just to see a concert. A primary care physician in Las Vegas, who said he had been Stephen Paddock's doctor since 2009, he said that he saw him roughly a year before the shooting, and he told officials that he suspected that Stephen had bipolar disorder. So let's talk about bipolar disorder for a second. So bipolar disorder is generally characterized by extreme changes in mood, at times going from extremely happy and almost euphoric feeling to periods of really strong depression. They can also have extreme changes in activity levels and energy, going from having tons of energy to having no energy at all. It should be noted that the majority of people who have bipolar disorder, they are not violent people. In addition to Stephen's doctors suspecting that he might be bipolar, his doctor also made notes that described him as behaving a bit oddly and also showing little emotion. He also mentioned that Stephen had a fear of medications and that he had refused prescriptions for antidepressants, but ultimately he did accept a prescription for anti-anxiety medication. Still, again, none of this points directly to a clear motive. In the 12 months following the mass shooting in Las Vegas, many early reports stated that Stephen didn't have any kind of political affiliation. However, years later, in September 2020, TheIntercept.com published an article in which it stated that Stephen Paddock appeared to be fixated on some extremist beliefs, including, quote, anti-government conspiracy theories, threats to Second Amendment rights, and overly burdensome taxes. One witness apparently told Las Vegas police that Paddock was, quote, kind of fanatical about his anti-government conspiracies, and he believed that someone had to, quote, wake up the American public and get them to arm themselves in response to looming threats. The Intercept also writes, family members and associates of Stephen Paddock painted a picture of a man who loathed restrictions on gun ownership and believed that the Second Amendment was under siege. The article also states that a man named Adam Lefebvre, I might be saying that wrong, dated the sister of Stephen Paddock's girlfriend. Adam stated that Stephen Paddock had an obsession with guns and would become quite angry when challenged on the Second Amendment. He said that Stephen Paddock, quote, made it very clear that he would have no part of gun ownership restrictions. He was animated about the government and the tax system. Las Vegas police detectives said that one unnamed source told them that a month before the shooting, Stephen Paddock tried to bribe the source into selling him a gun part used to convert a semi-automatic firearm into a fully automatic machine gun. When the source refused, telling Stephen that it was illegal, he said that Stephen became enraged. He spouted false conspiracy theories that the government planned to set up a, quote, detention camp of Americans as a means of widespread confiscation of guns. The source also told detectives that Stephen believed that Hurricane Katrina was just a dry run for law enforcement and military to start kicking down doors and confiscating guns. A different source within the investigation said that Stephen was, quote, paranoid and often ranted about U.S. government conspiracy theories. In September 2017, about a week before the shooting, Stephen Paddock insisted that his girlfriend go to the Philippines, which was her home country. Once she was there, he wired her $100,000. So clearly, he already had plans that he was about to do something really awful. On October 1st, 2017, Stephen Paddock opened fire onto a crowd of 22,000 people from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel on the Las Vegas Strip, killing 58 people and injuring over 800. I won't get into the gory details of this case because we literally all just witnessed that on our TVs just a few years ago. What I do want to focus on is how much we still don't understand as far as the psychology behind these kinds of incidents. When Stephen Paddock was alive, he was a bit overweight and he had exhibited some normal signs of aging. And he often told people that he was tired and he didn't feel well. But when the autopsy was performed, it showed that Stephen was relatively healthy and there were no obvious physical reasons that would explain why he had done that. Even though Stephen Paddock shot himself in the head, apparently experts at Stanford University said there was enough left of his brain to be able to examine it. They even conducted a microscopic brain examination, but didn't see anything that could directly link to the reason on why he committed such a violent act. I found an interesting article by the Washington Post published May 18th, 2016 by Michael S. Rosenwald. It's entitled, "Most Mass Shooters Aren't Mentally Ill, So Why Push Better Treatment as the Answer?" The article says, quote, "While acknowledging that some of the country's worst mass shooters were psychotic, such as the Colorado theater gunman James Holmes with his crazy orange dyed hair and the Virginia Tech shooter and so on, experts say that the vast majority of such killers did not have any classic forms of serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia or psychosis. The author suggests that these people are just ruthless psychopaths and sociopaths who can't typically be treated as a mental illness. To me, that's not just much different than just going, well, he's just a monster." A forensic psychologist, Michael Stone, who is the author of the book, The Anatomy of Evil, maintains a database of more than 300 killers, most of them shooters of four or more people. He essentially breaks mental illness into two categories. And the first category are those with schizophrenia, delusions, psychosis, that sort of thing, who are suffering from serious mental illness, but who can be helped with medical treatment. And the second category are those with personality disorders like paranoia, sociopathy, and psychopathy. The key thing about psychopaths is that they don't feel compassion or sympathy. They also don't feel remorse, shame, or guilt either. They have weak connections within the brain's emotional systems. And what's crazy is they even have a hard time recognizing the facial expression of someone who is frightened. And they are more tolerant of upsetting images like mutilation and gore and that sort of thing. On a side note, when I was researching this topic, I actually learned something a little frightening, that about 1% of the population actually meets the criteria for psychopathy. That means that one out of every 100 people walking around is a possible psychopath. Sweet dreams. Good night. It also should be noted that many people who are murderers are psychopaths, but not all psychopaths are murderers. They're just giant fucking assholes. The Washington Post article also says, quote, "Michael Stone found that just 2 out of 10 mass killers were suffering from serious mental illness, like schizophrenia or psychosis. The rest had personality or antisocial disorders or were disgruntled, jilted, humiliated, or full of intense rage. They were unlikely to be identified or helped by the mental health care system." However, I will point out, I don't necessarily agree with any of that. I'll point out that both Stephen Paddock and Charles Whitman did not seemingly fit into the category of schizophrenia or sociopathic disorders. Schizophrenia is such an extreme mental illness that it's usually really obvious to those who are around you that something is severely wrong with you. And no one ever said anything like that about Stephen Paddock or Charles Whitman. And as far as being a psychopath, both Paddock and Whitman did seem to have moments of compassion and kindness. Remember, Charles Whitman saved his Marine buddies who were trapped under the wrecked Jeep. And a friend of Stephen Paddock described him as generous when he and his girlfriend came to visit him. Stephen Paddock even made sure that his own girlfriend was taken care of by sending her $100,000. So to me, Michael Stone's assessment doesn't exactly match these two particular cases. I'm going to take a left turn now and get into Stephen Paddock's brother, Bruce Paddock. And this is just so freaking weird. So I want to talk to you guys about this guy. Just a few weeks after the Las Vegas shooting in October 2017, Stephen Paddock's brother, Bruce Paddock, who was 58 years old, he was arrested with multiple charges against him relating to possession of child pornography or the sexual exploitation of children. Original reports stated that he was accused of having 600 pornographic images of children. Apparently, in 2014, Bruce Paddock was having a hard time in life and he was down on his luck. His longtime friend owned some kind of car garage, auto shop type of business. So Bruce took his car to the guy's auto shop to be repaired. And then he just decided, I know, I'm just going to live here. So Bruce holed himself up in the attic of his longtime friend's auto shop and he just squatted there. The owner of the shop, he couldn't get rid of him. And as weeks were going by, Bruce was becoming increasingly more aggressive and violent towards not only the shop's owner, but also the employees and the customers. At one point, he even threatened to kill the owner and burn the shop down. The other thing that was really weird is he was starting to get slightly delusional as well, and he began to even think that he owned the shop. It was really crazy what was happening in this guy's head. The owner of the shop eventually was finally able to get rid of Bruce. He got him evicted, and once that happened, Bruce just seemingly took off and disappeared. He left behind a computer at the shop, which was discovered to have allegedly tons of child porn on it. The shop's owner handed the computer over to the police, but by then, Bruce was gone, and cops just assumed that he was a transient and just said they couldn't find him. And so they just sort of just let that go and forgot about it. So that was in 2014. So in the following 3 years, Los Angeles police, prosecutors, investigators, they just didn't know where he went and just seemingly gave up. But just weeks after the Vegas shooting, Bruce Paddock was miraculously found and arrested. But an LAPD spokesperson said that the timing was a coincidence. So how did they find Bruce after 3 years of him having gone missing? Apparently, when the 2017 Vegas shooting happened, Bruce Paddock was living in a nursing home in Los Angeles. Now, TMZ reports that the day after Stephen Paddock had murdered 58 people in Las Vegas, his brother Bruce was allegedly bragging to the people at the assisted living facility where he was staying that the Las Vegas shooter was his brother. The police and the FBI were called, and within all of this, a warrant for Bruce's arrest from the previous child pornography charges, that popped up, and they got the address of where he was staying at the assisted living home, and they went over there, cops showed up, and they arrested Bruce Paddock. About 5 months later, in March 2018, that was the beginning of Bruce's court hearings. During one of the initial court hearings, a Los Angeles police officer stated that the investigators had found more than 1,000 images of child pornography on 236 CDs that allegedly belonged to Bruce, and therefore 20 different criminal charges had been filed against him. However, his defense attorney was able to get 19 of the 20 criminal charges dropped because of the statute of limitations. It had expired. Because police couldn't find him after he left the auto shop and they just seemingly gave up back in 2014, that caused too much time to pass. And so that's where you get into the expiration of the statute of limitations. So the judge did order, though, that Bruce stand trial for the one remaining charge that wasn't dropped, and that was the charge of felony possession of child pornography. So Bruce pled not guilty to that one charge, but within a couple of months, the whole entire case was thrown out anyway. In May 2018, a judge ordered that the case be dismissed because the prosecutors said that the key witness, which was the guy who owned the auto shop, he was out of the country and prosecutors couldn't get to him. So they asked the judge to postpone the case to allow them time to get their witness back into the country. And the judge said no, and the whole entire case was thrown out. One weird thing that I found online was that the Daily Mail, which normally isn't really that reputable of a source, but they claimed that the reason that the case was thrown out was because Bruce Paddock's defense attorney claimed that the LA deputy district attorney's daughter was allegedly killed in the Las Vegas mass shooting by Bruce Paddock's brother, Steven. And he said that there was no way that they could have a fair trial as a result of that. But outside of the Daily Mail, I couldn't find any other sources to verify whether that information was true or not. Either way, when the judge threw out the case, prosecutors vowed to refile the charges. Did they? It doesn't seem like it. I couldn't find any follow-up stories to that. I searched online and it doesn't appear that the prosecutors followed through. It seems like they just couldn't get their shit together. They couldn't organize their case. They went, oh, well, and they just moved on from this guy who was clearly contributing to the sexual abuse of children. Now, here's something else that's wild that I only recently learned about. Apparently, not only was Bruce collecting hundreds and hundreds of child pornography images, but his brother Steven, the Las Vegas shooter, did exactly the same thing. In 2018, ABC News reported that, quote, the analysis of a computer belonging to Las Vegas mass shooter Steven Paddock revealed a disturbing search history and numerous images of child pornography, said investigators. In the months, weeks, and days leading up to the October 1st, 2017 shooting, Steven Paddock searched online for open-air concert venues. Several hundred images of child pornography were also found on the hard drive of Steven Paddock's laptop, according to the report. It also said that as of 2018, quote, officers are still investigating the source of the images. I wasn't able to find any follow-up to that either. So, the bottom line is that both of the Paddock brothers collected massive amounts of child pornography. And I would guess, and this is just speculation, but the fact that they're brothers, okay, and they're both doing this. And I would imagine that each brother would know that the other brother was doing this, right? I mean, there's no way that they could be brothers and both of them were that much into child pornography and they didn't know that the other brother was into that as well. So I would think that the brothers would either maybe like exchange some of these images with each other, or maybe they would tell each other where to find more of these images, you know? So I just find it hard to believe that the two brothers both did this and didn't know that the other one was doing it too. So with that said, here's something else that I wonder. Had prosecutors actually followed up with Bruce's child pornography case back in 2014, could that have led them to the child pornography on Steven's computer, possibly putting him away in prison before he had a chance to commit that horrible crime of the shooting in Las Vegas? We'll never know, but I think that the biggest takeaway is that we all need to have an education about all of this stuff. I mean, if I had a magic wand, I would implement that we all start receiving an education about psychology, self-awareness, and the ability to spot potential problems in each other so that we can offer help. And this education really needs to start from a very young age. Charles Whitman clearly knew that something was wrong with him. And imagine if he had the tools and the education and the resources to actually know how to help himself. Speaking of resources, this country definitely needs to do an overhaul on how it handles mental health issues. As often as we see hospitals and urgent care clinics, we need the same resources to help ourselves, our loved ones, and our peers who are in crisis. We need to all have an understanding of how to deal with people who may be experiencing extreme disorders like schizophrenia or psychopathy. And we need to be able to look at this from a clinical perspective, not one of judgment. Because the more that we all walk around with no education, limited resources, while carrying fear or passing judgment, the more likely that we are to completely miss the next Steven Paddock or Charles Whitman. Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening and for watching. And please let me know what you guys think in the comments below. Also, don't forget to show your support by clicking the subscribe button on my YouTube channel and be sure to click the like button if you enjoyed this. Also, please be sure to visit my website, talkoflove.net, and check out all the rewards that you guys can get by becoming a contributor. Oh, and one last thing, if you guys are into this true crime stuff, please be sure to check out a podcast by one of Talk of Love's longtime contributors, Jesse, who has been hosting his own true crime podcast called All I Know Is I Don't Know. Love that title. And he's been doing this for several months now and is starting to grow. It's really interesting stuff that he talks about. The podcast is very straightforward and he aims to tell stories that aren't as popular and are truly unbelievable. So if you grew up with Forensic Files or America's Most Wanted or Law & Order, you may have to give this podcast a chance. And I think you guys are going to really dig it. So once again, the podcast is called All I Know Is I Don't Know. And it's available on all podcast streaming platforms. You can also follow him on Instagram at All I Know Is I Don't Know. So thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you guys for watching and for supporting. Please stay safe. And I will see you all next week. Take care.